Today I had a couple of topics in mind. I started with this idea. Are the people I was still around me? Do they stay with me all through life? And is the same thing true of you? So where are the people I was? Where is the infant that I was, the 8-year-old child that I was, the 14-year-old that I was, even the 20-year-old and 30-year-old? Where are they? The question is, do those forms still exist? Do those forms of me hang around? Do they influence me? Or are they like, I'll say, the form of memories, conscious and subconscious, simply get put into some sort of storage facility, our memory banks, our inventory of images, of sensory perception, like visualizations or auditory files or kinesthetic files or so on? Do those things just stay there and we label them in this generic term of memories? I wanted to explore that idea. I wanted to know if I am only one form of consciousness, right? I was conceived and I had a certain level of consciousness. Then over time, do I morph and shapeshift, go from a fertilized ovum? Do I start adding cells and adding cells? And at some point, am I born and then I'm an individual? And I grow. I grow in a lot of different ways. I grow spiritually and mentally, emotionally and physically, largely by adding experiences and meanings and beliefs, opinions, superstitions, prejudices, wisdom. And some of that stuff is generated by us as individuals. But when we're younger, it comes from people around us. They bombard us with their prejudices, their wisdom, their opinions, their old wives' tales, and so on. And so are we one container, and have we always been one container of consciousness that keeps getting added to? Or are the forms of me and the forms of you like separate individuals seeking to continue their existence, even though when we look in the mirror, we go, well, I'm not a 5-year-old child any longer. I'm not an 8-year-old child or a 10 or a 12 or a 20-year-old child. So those things don't really exist. Well, they may not exist in physical form because we're looking in the mirror and we can see, we think, well, I'm a certain age and I think I exist right there. I think so. But we understand that, you know, certain impulses seem to override all others. And depending on who you talk to, and it can be far afield, they can be religious people, philosophers, metaphysicians, medical doctors, a whole bunch of people will come up with this one overriding impulse. That is our impulse to survive. So you'd go, if I have a form of consciousness, say a 5-year-old, that's me at 5, that's you at 5, don't those forms of our consciousness want to survive? Do they want to survive as 5-year-olds? Or do they, at a 5-year-old, I don't want to be a 5-year-old, I want to be a 20-year-old. I think the impulse to survive might mean that all of these different forms of our consciousness still exist. If you had a conversation with people, many of them would think that survival is, we're talking survival, that's, we're talking physical. That's talking about the physical me, but I think that's a limited view. Minute by minute, millions of cells in our bodies are dying and others are coming into existence as cells multiply. But when those millions of cells die, minute by minute, it's happening without much drama on our part. We're not freaking out. We're not going crazy about those cells dying. Maybe there's a drama on a cellular level as a cell is going, I'm suffocating, I'm dehydrated, I'm dying, I'm filled with toxic waste. Maybe that's happening on a cellular level, but you and I are not perceiving that kind of thing on our organism level. So we overlook it. But if you turn around and look at legacy, for instance, you know, what is your legacy? You know, after you're physically gone, what of you is going to remain? And for some people, they think in terms of descendants. Oh, I've got a son that's going to pass my bloodline on. I've got daughters. I've got, you know, I've got these great buildings I built, or these works of arts that I've created. You know, I did all these things. Look at Donald Trump. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. I think that's ego to an extreme. It's like everything is labeled with his name. Trump, Trump, Trump. Trump this, Trump that. Trump, Trump, Trump. So I'm going to use Trump before this talk is over in a different context. So you could say, we want to survive in the minds of other people, whether they're our relatives or people that we help or donate money to or strangers that read our books or our great American novels, that sort of thing. So we want history to be able to remember us long after our physical bodies die. If I'm talking about a physical body, pretty much everybody goes, yep, I got that idea. I got that idea. But I want to talk about the idea, and I think this is pretty easy for a lot of people to conceptualize too, is the idea that we have four bodies. Just perhaps that's true. We have four bodies. We look in the mirror, we go, yep, I see one, okay? And the others that you cannot see, we could consider them to be spiritual bodies, mental body, and emotional body. So if we've got these four bodies, I would think there are a couple of concepts, maybe more, that are important to this. Sometimes, and this is an electrical term, you know, for things to be in phase or things to be out of phase, you may have heard these kind of words. That person is really, really together. That person is really coherent. That person is really focused. I think that could be interpreted as meaning this. All four of that person's body are in harmony. They're all unified into this one single whole. And that's why when that person is talking to you, she or he is like, they're there. I mean, you get that because they're not, you know, physically standing in front of you and out on the highway in an argument with somebody who just cut them off and then not thinking of, you know, their toast got burned 2 days ago. Those people are fragmented or out of phase or out of focus. So if you were to say we have four bodies, and I have to tell you that some people believe that we have way more than four bodies, 15 or 18 or 20. But for the purposes of this conversation, that's kind of complex. So I'm going to just stick with these four as a model. And this shows up in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Edgar Cayce mentions these four bodies, and lots of different other sources refer to these four bodies. So that's where we're going to stay temporarily with this idea. So you could say, I wonder, is this emotional body, is this mental body the same one that I started with at conception? Well, it, probably not, because we would have added a lot of information, a lot of knowledge, a lot of experiences. So what we understand mentally at one day old is certainly different than what we understand when we're 5 years old, or 10, or 20, or 30. You go, And my physical body, too, has changed dramatically since conception, since birth, from one day old to right now. You go, yeah. A lot of things are changing. A lot of stuff is being added. A lot of stuff is being subtracted from an energy standpoint, from a physical standpoint. You go, yep, I got this idea. I got it. So now, if we're looking at these four bodies, and we just imagine that each one of them might have its own consciousness. For the purpose of this talk, I think this may be true. I'm not sure. You can decide on it for yourself. That our spiritual body doesn't really get affected. Our spiritual body is that connecting link between us and divine consciousness. That is really, really us, and it is that connecting link. So if we're having a bad hair day, we're not impacting our spiritual body. that is just maintaining its same position, its same knowingness of who and what we are, maybe displaying the same kind of patience and understanding and acceptance that divine consciousness would have toward us. But the others, the mental, the emotional, and the physical bodies, you could go, who's in charge? Who's in charge? You and I know this example for sure. Here we are in 2013, and we say, I want to be healthy. I want to be disciplined. I want to be fit and trimmed. I want to be successful. I want to be loving. I want to be kind. I want to be a whole bunch of things we want to be. Well, why aren't we? Maybe because when we start to take a step in that direction of trying to do in order to help this being come into experience to be real right here in 2013, maybe all our doing, all of a sudden, I can't make myself do it. I can't make myself do it. I want to exercise. I want to be, you know, put the fork down. I want to stop smoking and drinking and doing about a million other things that are harmful to being healthy, being happy, being successful, being this, being loving, so on. So who's in charge in those circumstances? You go, Yeah. I made a decision. I want to lose 5 pounds, but all of a sudden I notice me picking up a Twinkie or something. It's like, wait a minute. Well, who decided on losing the 5 pounds? Maybe my mental body. And who decided you wanted a Twinkie or some other junk food? My emotional body? Or maybe even in cahoots with my physical body, which is addicted to sugar. That's a big thing for Americans, right? Addicted to sugar. And it's not an accident. You know, the pushers, they're not standing on the street corners. They're in corporate boardrooms making these decisions, you know, twirling their mustaches. Let's get them addicted to junk food and sugar. And you're like, yeah. So who is making the decision that when we want to exercise, we put the brakes on and go in the opposite direction? It's like, that's not my mental body, because my mental body said, let's go exercise. I can see this kind of scenario. I have 4 older sisters, so this is pretty real to me. How about 3 older sisters? I didn't want to promote my younger sister to be older than me. She would not be pleased with that. 3 older sisters. They had paper dolls laying around the house and a bunch of other stuff too, right? And so just imagine you have 4 paper dolls. Each one, you cut out 4 paper dolls. They look like you, and they could be labeled spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical. Those are the 4 you. And I would have those 4, and everybody else would have those 4. And we go, okay. So who's in charge? Well, I think it depends on the circumstance, wouldn't you think? So you go, My survival is an underlying rule of all 4 of those bodies. They want me to survive. So now, how are they going to help me? Well, the mental body might say, you know what, if you learn more, if you know more, if you're more aware, if we understand how the world works, how life works, if we understand the truth of existence, if we understand creation, if we understand, I think maybe our chances of survival and even thriving are much greater. But if we've got experiences in our emotional inventory, in our experiences emotionally, that every time we try to learn something, maybe we made a mistake. Maybe we got yelled at. Maybe there was some sort of trauma. Maybe there was some sort of emotional pain or physical pain that involved that. You know, what are you doing trying to learn stuff? You know, get out there and plow those back 40 acres. I've met, well, over the phone anyway, clients that grew up in circumstances like that, where working the farm was the priority, doing chores was the priority. Learning stuff? Nope. Other than learning how to get out of bed at 4 in the morning, put on your coveralls, go out and slop the hogs and feed the cows and do whatever you need to do in order to, you know, keep the farm running. But learning as a concept to make you more successful in the world, not necessary to them, not necessary according to their parents. Just do this job for 60 or 70 years, and then you're going to fall over dead, and then your kids are going to continue this process. It's like, yikes, yikes. We think there might be something more than that, or you wouldn't be on this call, and I wouldn't be on this call. We constantly are looking for a greater understanding, a greater emotional balance, a greater physical vitality. We want our bodies to be in phase, in focus, all in alignment with one another, so we can cause desirable effects. So if you can see yourself, you want to be or do or have something, and then all of a sudden, you can't make that happen. You can't be or do or have that. You really are in a position to go, whoa, 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 let me see who's in charge now. What just popped up? I think that my decision-making was a mental process. I want this. This is my goal. And this, that, that. And then something emotionally or some physical habit intruded. People who are trying to overcome physical addiction, say cigarette smoking, have got to deal with cigarette smoking on multiple levels. The imagery that they've created mentally that this activity is connected to some positive, some good. So that's a mental thing. And the emotionality that's attached to that, it's like, oh yeah, it feels like peace, which was the image that I had as a little kid attached to cigarette smoking, and added others after, over time, you know, rebelliousness and independence and freedom and being a wise guy and, you know, being cool and all that junk. All false, by the way. So there's an emotional connection to that imagery of that habit. And then there's physicality. There's physicality. And you can see it with people who are trying to quit smoking, for instance, or do anything else that changes a physical habit. Now, all of a sudden, they're like, what do I do with my hands? What do I do with my hands? This was one of the things I said when I quit smoking in January 1975. What do I do with all of my hands? I had no idea I had so many hands that were looking to, because with cigarette smoking, there's all kinds of ritualized behavior, tapping the cigarettes and tapping the ash and doing this and fooling with the lighter and on and on and on. You take that away from somebody, their hands are unemployed. It's like, what do I do? What do I do? Those hands need to do something because they're used to moving in certain directions, doing certain behaviors, and that has to be accounted for. So quitting an addiction is like, has to encompass my way of thinking, three of those four bodies. And the spiritual is observing this, knowing that ultimately, this lifetime, next lifetime, lifetime after that, or after that, this is going to be resolved. So no real hurry, no urgency, no anxiety. Oh, he's got to get it done in this lifetime. I don't think so. So as we look at that and recognize that when we make a decision and then try to take action, our emotional bodies are going to go, ah, I'm totally in agreement with this. Let's do it. Let's do it. And and they slam the brakes on. They try to protect us, not letting us move ahead. I think this could be a valuable set of images for people who say, I want more throughput. And who is that? Who wants more throughput? All of you and me and everybody you know and everybody I know. We want to have more energy flow that comes to us and through us and can be used productively by us. Productively meaning will produce desirable results, not only for ourselves, but we want to be of value to other people. Can't just be only about us. That imbalanced self-interest will sabotage us because that is not in harmony with our deepest, deepest humanity. Well, our ego may say, there's nobody else on the planet but you and me, and, you know, the heck with the rest of them. And it seems, if you look around at the news, it's like, wow, people actually still believe that. Yeah. People that don't recognize their interconnection with other human beings, with the planets, with animals, might think there's only one person on the planet, me, and the hell with everything else. Like, that is not workable. If the law of cause and effect is a valid concept, we reap what we sow. I just as soon sow seeds of love if I'm capable, if I'm aware enough to do that, rather than be greedy and cruel and the other things, which I think all people have the capability to be, but as a way of life, not that good, because the harvest that that stuff brings doesn't make for a happy harvest. We're not going to be happy with that at all. So as you go through your daily life, you can ask yourself, who's in charge? Which me is now driving the vehicle? You know, I'm going to go to the grocery store. Okay, that's a decision. That's a mental thing. It may have been provoked by hunger. You know, oh, I'm starving. There's nothing in the house. The refrigerator's empty. And those sorts of things. But I made the decision to go to the grocery store. Now what happens? That mental body that is now gets behind the wheel in this physical body of mine and drives to the grocery store. But if I were agoraphobic, if I hate public, going to the public, my grocery stores, Publix, if I hate going out in public and if I don't like people and I don't want to go into in confined spaces and, you know, got those things kind of going on, you're like, all of a sudden that emotional body is going to be trying to grab that steering wheel, like, no, we don't, you know. And now I'm in conflict. Part of me wants to go forward, and part of me wants to go back. Sometimes this is unconscious conflict. We don't really recognize it, but sometimes it's conscious conflict. It's like, I want to do this. I'm supposed to do it. I have to do it. I need to do it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And so we're like a child battling the adult. So we're both of these people. It's like, yikes, this is problematic. If I've got this thing going on, you can look at yourself and notice this in a variety of contexts. You can say, wow, I made a decision, and then all of a sudden, I was in a fight with my emotional body. I had a mentor years ago who was talking about maturity and immaturity, and he defined it like this. He made two lists of three characteristics. He said, you know, this is mature thinking. Mature thinking, step number one, is a decision. We decide what we want. Step two, we take action to bring that into physical manifestation. Step three, we use our emotions to reinforce our action or to adjust our action, and then we take more action. I said, okay, that's cool. What's immature thinking? He said, immature thinking starts, number one, with an emotion. I have this emotion, and as a result of that, I have to take action or no action. No action, inaction, is an action. Slamming on your brakes to prevent yourself from going forward is an action. So if step number one is emotion, step number two is action, based upon that emotion. And step number three is decision. It's like, Joey, why did you punch Bobby? I had to. He made me mad. It's like, yeah, I had this feeling, and consequently, I had to do this or not do this. You don't have to be a little child to have those kind of processes active. It's like, oh, wow, You can hear it in the context of the bodies that I'm talking about, that one is a mental body makes a decision. Ideally, the emotional body is in harmony with this because we can see the value, the benefit, the payoff from this set of actions to be or do or to have something. It's like, oh. And so now we're coherent. We're in focus. We're in phase. And now our physical bodies go all ahead full. You go, yep, that's cool. You and I know we have plenty of experiences where our emotions take over and prevent us from doing something that moments before we indicated to ourselves in our self-talk or maybe to somebody else that we wanted to do it. This is one of the great things about the book Influence by Cialdini, C-I-A-L-D-I-N-I. I think his first name, if I remember, is Robert Influence. He said, if we express what we want to do, which we've decided to do, to somebody else, we have a greater commitment to that path of action. If you can get somebody to verbally commit to do something, their ability to do it is far greater. Their commitment to doing it is far greater. And that book has a lot of different case studies or anecdotes in which he proves his points about how to influence yourself, how to influence other people, and how to know when other people are trying to influence you. And so it's really a very valuable work to be able to read that and get it and how people do it. It's like, yeah. And so if we verbalize what we've decided to do, we have already put ourselves in motion. We've already started the momentum. So if you can get a person, a family member, a client, a friend to commit to what they want to do, their chances of doing it are far greater. If you can verbalize your own intention of doing something, you're going to be far more committed to doing it as well. It's very easy to see how an emotional body might override us. So how about the physical body? Well, I already talked about having more than two hands when you quit smoking or you stop doing something that you've done all the time with your hands. But when the physical body feels pain or hunger or tired, you know that we're going to notice it. Not all the time do we interpret it correctly. You know, there are people that believe that the first symptom of hunger is not actually hunger at all. It's dehydration. And tiredness is dehydration or lack of oxygen. So if we stretched or drank a glass of water or breathed deeply a few times, those interpretations would shift very rapidly, and we wouldn't be marching on the way to Snickers or Starbucks to get a fix. Now, marketing says 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you need a Snickers or you need a Starbucks. But, when you think about that stuff, you go, really? Really? That's what my body is begging for? Sugar? High fructose corn syrup? I'm down a quart, or I'm down a quart of coffee and because of the caffeine. It's like, if you're hungry, you're hungry. Legitimately hungry, you're hungry. You're going to want to use food instead of junk food. And if you're legitimately tired, instead of using caffeine, we're going to want to rest. I think I'll honor the body. I think one of the things that's overlooked with rest, meditation, prayer, sleep, is we are getting our minds out of the way. That mental, I'm in charge, I'll do it. Oh, we got to do this, and we need to do that. No, oh, I'll be careful of that. No, yeah, no, that's no good. And, oh, that's silly. That's a foolish activity. And, oh, if we could only go without sleep, we'd get so much more done. If we can get that noisy thing out of the way, then all of a sudden we would be able to receive awareness from a consciousness that's far greater than our own. And you go, oh, so actually, rest not only gives my body a chance to do maintenance, it's like putting the vehicle in the shop for needed maintenance, it is allowing the reorganization of information that I've acquired over the day and maybe over the lifetime, and I am getting refueled by higher consciousness. Wow. I think going to sleep at night at a reasonable hour is probably a good idea. I'll say that. Yeah, it's probably a good idea. I would encourage us to think of it. It's like, a lot of people go, this sleep is wasting time. I can recall this maybe 10 or 12 years ago. I thought, if only I could do without sleep, I could get so much more done. You know what I know today? That is absolutely, absolutely false. And in fact, working more might oftentimes be the way to get less productivity. If you want to get less done, work more. You go, oh, how is that possible? Because we're ineffective, we're inefficient, we're sloppy, we make mistakes, we do things over and over again. Whoops, wrong turn. Oops, we got lost. Whoops, I shouldn't have done that. Whoops, that was wasted time and effort. Like, let me go back and clarify my decision. Let me work on this mentally. Here's a recommendation. I started to reread the book last night, The Man Who Tapped the Secrets of the Universe. And I specifically recommend that to you. The Man Who Tapped the Secrets of the Universe is about Walter Russell, and the author is Glenn Clark, G-L-E-N-N Clark, C-L-A-R-K, Glenn Clark. And I'm starting to read it, and I'm going, this guy is a modern-day Leonardo da Vinci when he was alive, world famous in a half a dozen different areas, amazing, amazing man, and thinks we all could do the same thing. We all have genius in us if we would just take the time, rest, meditate, pray, and open up to receive it from the divine. Walter Russell, I noticed, because I read this years ago, is using words that I'm finding in the Christ letters, in Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. He's referring to divine consciousness. He's referring to universal consciousness. He's referring to the equilibrium. He's using the same words. So his genius, he was sourcing it from the divine, which he says is the only place it's going to be sourced. All geniuses are accessing it from the divine. So if you want to be a genius, if you want to get more done, if you want to be a master of some different field, you need to be connected to the divine. That's pretty, pretty exciting. While it might be easier for us to think of ourselves as only one person, because it's easier to dress, oh, I only have to put up one, going out to lunch in an hour or so, oh, I only have to put one shirt on, one pair of slacks, one pair of shoes, oh, yeah, that's easy. But when you really consider how we think and feel and speak and act, you go, wow, I am so varied, you're so varied, you have such a wide range of thinking, feeling, speaking, and acting that almost is context-driven. You go, it's hard to believe I'm only one person. So that's why it does make sense that we have at least those four bodies, doesn't it? And so if you were to look at that and say, okay, so I'm going to just talk about this idea. And this is where I've kind of started to shift gears in my thinking. I wanted to talk originally about the idea that are the people I was still around? But now I want to think, what face do I present in any situation? What face do you present? You know, everybody says, oh, that person's a phony. You know, they got a facade up, or they got a defensive barrier up. They're wearing armor, or it's hard to see, who they really are. You've had those thoughts, you've had those experiences, and you've had those words. So turn around and say, okay, what? Just imagine for a second the face of those four paper dolls that I talked about, the one labeled spiritual, mental, emotional, physical. How would they be? How would you look at those face of that on that card and go, oh, let me see. I'm thinking that the face of the spiritual body is going to have a gentle, knowing, I don't know, maybe almost like a Mona Lisa kind of look, knowing that everything is going to work out, and it's working out in perfect timing, and it's all good. Trust, acceptance, there's peace, there's loving, there's gentleness there. You go, yeah, I can imagine that spiritual body having that kind of loving smile on its face. But then you turn around and say to them, what about the mental body? What is your mental body? What face does it wear? I think there's a real variation here. But the one that comes up is this kind of eyebrows scrunched together, like we're thinking real hard trying to do a math problem or solve some other riddle in our lives or dealing with some of the situation that seems kind of complex right now. We're thinking hard, you know, we got eyebrows together. It's like, I'm trying to understand this. I'm trying to make sense out of it. I'm trying to see what makes this tick. How does life work? And you go, Because we want to understand that, We want to use that mental body, our mental capabilities, because if we understand we're more aware, then we can take actions that are going to be more effective, that are going to produce what we want in our lives, going to fulfill our needs. It's like, yeah, that's right. Those are my purposes. And I'm trying to figure this out. I'm trying to figure this stuff, life out. Years ago in a previous marriage, my then wife said, what are you thinking about? I'm just, the meaning of life, trying to, yeah, that's it, the meaning of the cosmos, I'm working on that right now, whatever, and that was the end of that conversation. So let's think about the emotional body. What kind of faces do we wear on the emotional body? You go, whoa, wow, I've had tears running down my face, so I know that one. I've seen giddy laughter on that face. I've seen anger on that face. I've seen sadness and disappointment. I've seen excitement, enthusiastic. Oh, I've seen a lot of different emotions on that face. Yeah. Yep. Me too. But I'll bet you could do this. If you turn around, what face do you typically wear mentally and emotionally on your body? What is your normal face? Not normal in the sense that, psychologically this is normal, but on a regular basis, the most usual face that you're wearing emotionally. You go, If we went out today, and it's a beautiful day here in Florida, as usual, and went out to a playground and saw children playing, you could look at those children, and what would appear on our emotional faces and our physical faces would be gentle, admiring, that the way kids so innocently play. They're like, I can do that when I look at our puppy. It's like, I can do that when I look at my wife. I can be amazed and in awe when I look at my avocado tree. Every day the avocados are getting bigger. They're almost thumb size now. It's like really cool. I probably could stand there and watch them grow. It's like, wow, I can see them. They're moving, so, and it's easy enough to know when we go out in traffic or we got to stand in line if I've got to wait for this lunch that's coming up, or the service is always good in the place we're going, so that's not a problem. But, you know, if I wanted to go back and access memories of having lousy service in a restaurant, I probably could find that. I typically only get great service, but I'm sure I could find something. Now I'm really worried about what kind of service we're going to get here today. But just think of all the faces that you've had on your emotional body over time, and the one that you typically use today. But what face are you going to wear when you don't get what you want? Right? And if I say, I want to order X, and they go, we're all out of X. Oh, okay, well, I'll go for my second choice, Y. We're all out of Y.
I bet that guy's face is going to show all kinds of things because he's not getting what he wants. So when you don't get what you want, what face do you put on? What face do you wear? Like, and we go into a victim, just more evidence we can't have what we want. And then you turn around and go, no, that's not the face I wear. I use, I get angry. Well, I want what I want. What's wrong with you people? And we get into blame. Or it's like, okay, let me find, as a third choice, let me find something excellent on this menu that under normal circumstances I wouldn't choose because I'd go for my two favorites. Let me see. I'm going to explore. Those choices are available to us. And you go, that's interesting. Knowing how we react when we don't get what we want is a huge, huge concept. And knowing how other people react when they don't get what they want is also huge. If you're the mother of a child, you're like, let me see. And this is a great opportunity for parenting and coaching to explain a whole bunch of meaningful concepts to a child know, other people have self-interest, not just you. There's got to be balance. Some things take longer to manifest than others. On and on and on. Economics, time, and those sorts of things can all come into play. And now all of a sudden this child, without being invalidated, made wrong, goes like, oh, wow, mom, dad, I'm getting this. I'm getting this idea that there are other concepts that need to come into place. I would say one of the challenges we have when we don't get what we want is either going victim or going angry. And now if we go outward, we try to induce the other person with our victim. Oh, I'm so disappointed. I'm so disappointed. You can't believe I'm so disappointed that I didn't get X or Y, hoping that they're going to mysteriously and magically pull an entree out of their hat, trying to use guilt and make them feel bad about it. Or if we turn that inward, we turn that disappointment inward, we're going to end up, in all likelihood, at self-pitying. Then if you turn around and say, no, I don't go that way, I'm going angry. Well, if we go outward, we're going to blame them for being incompetent, not judging their clientele, not provisioning appropriately. But if we turn that anger inward, we're going to blame ourselves. We're going to castigate ourselves. We're going to beat ourselves up for failing in our attempt to get what we want, and disempower ourselves even more. We don't want to go in either of those two directions. So, take a moment now and consider this idea, what face you would put on, that you would wear usually when you're going through these situations. If you're going to the movies, what face do you put on? Going to buy gas for your car needs gas, and you're specifically making a trip for that purpose. You're going to work, either in-home or driving to work. What face are you wearing? Going to breakfast or lunch and dinner outside the home, or even inside your home. You may go, or excitement, or some other face might be the one that you put on. Going grocery shopping. Going to get your car maintained. You've got to take it to the dealership or to a mechanic because time for an oil change, or you hear some weird noises or something. What face do you wear? Going to the doctors. To go to the doctors, too, from my point of view, the greatest reason to go to a doctor is to prove nothing is wrong, get another opinion that nothing serious is wrong. But if you love going to the doctor for attention or something else, you go like, you might want to see what's driving that, what emotional, mental connection you've got to that image. Cleaning your kitchen or your bathroom or some other part of your home. What face do you put on before you undertake that chore? Or even when you think of it, exercising, doing physical exercise, going for a walk or something more vigorous. What face do you wear? And going into an unknown social situation such as a party or a meeting of some sort, you know, on any topic, what face do you tend to wear? And you certainly could look at that list and go, whoa, there, I could add a lot more to it. And so why don't you do that? You find yourself going into certain situations and you know that habitually you put on a certain face, pun intended, before you walk into that situation. And those situations, when you start to think about it for just a couple of minutes, they're going to come into your awareness and you go, yeah, that's right. This is the face that I put on. This is what's in charge, my physical, my emotional, my mental body, and this is the armor that I put on or I don't put on. That's a very real set of concepts. By looking at that, you can make a higher choice because when we become mindful of what we're doing, we can upgrade what we're doing. Oh, I think I want to heal that pattern of walking into situations with my defenses up, or I'm going to isolate and really hold back. We can become aware of what is driving our behaviors, what face we're wearing, which part of us is in charge in any and every situation. And I think there's a huge amount of value in that idea. I would like to end the service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8. In Christ Returns, reveals startling truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal, loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.